Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we are going deep on 5G. Where do we stand around 5G in the US, in Canada, around the world? How has the messaging from carriers, from manufacturers, from the silicon vendors, how has that changed over the last year? And in general, in early 2021, do people need to care about 5G at all? Joining me this week to talk about it, our friend Jerry Hildenbrand, who has taken a couple weeks off, but it's nice to have you back. How are you?
Nice to be back. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. And welcoming you back after, I don't know, at least a year, I think, Sasha Segan, senior mobile analyst with PC Mag. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks a lot.
Good. It's great to have you back. I think I butchered your name. I always do that. Is it Sagan or Segan?
It's Segan. You got it right.
Okay. I got it right. Good. Okay. So we'll dive right in because you are probably the foremost expert in making 5G accessible to normies like the rest of us. And you do that on PCMag.com. You do it through a new newsletter, which I want you to tell us a bit about at the end. So I want to start with an email I got this morning from OpenSignal, and they are an independent analyst firm. They put out a lot of these reports around performance, network performance in particular countries in around the world as well. And what they are saying is that South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and the Netherlands largely top 5G performance for download speed, for peak speed, and for upload speed, respectively. And I want to use this as a jumping off point to just talk about every country is rolling out 5G at different speeds. They're using different spectrum. It's really complicated. But give us a sort of a high-level view of where we are in terms of 5G rollouts around the world, and use that to talk about where things stand a little bit more specifically in the US.
So I think the most important thing to understand about 5G technology is that it's not magic, and that just by putting a 5 in front of the G doesn't automatically change your performance or automatically give you fabulous new powers. A lot of the initial new abilities coming from 5G, a lot of the stuff that we talk about involving speed, is simply because 5G can use bigger, wider radio channels than 4G can. And if we look at the countries that have the best 5G performance, it's generally places where their governments have allocated the appropriate wide channels exclusively for 5G. And so you see places like South Korea, where they had a very orderly, very thoughtful allocation of useful mid-band spectrum to their carriers who cooperate moderately well. And so as a result, you have a really nice 5G layout that is operating in channels wider than could have been used for 4G. And is operating in cooperation with 4G, and so you have really good performance, as opposed to the United States. And in the US, the Trump FCC basically made a lot of bad decisions a few years ago about what frequencies to offer up for 5G initially. Mm-hmm. And the result is the vast majority of people in the US who see 5G on their phone, that 5G is just operating in the little odds and ends and corners of the existing 4G frequencies. It's just like, it's just using bits of leftover 4G, essentially. And so for the vast majority of 5G users, especially on AT&T and Verizon, they see that 5G, and they're like, this doesn't seem faster than 4G. In fact, it even sometimes seems slower. And they're right, because the 5G that they're getting, most of the people in AT&T and Verizon right now, is just little odds and ends of 4G with a number 5 tacked on. T-Mobile's in a slightly better position. T-Mobile, because of their purchase of Sprint, had some suitable mid-band 5G spectrum available. And over the last half of the year, of last year, they've been building out that spectrum in a lot of major cities. And so you're seeing their performance start to come up to what we expect from some of these European and Asian networks. But AT&T and Verizon are really struggling. And we're going to talk about C-band later. That is probably the solution for them. Then if you get to Canada, they also, so the Canadian carriers also did not get a lot of good 5G spectrum yet, but they've been a little smarter about how they've deployed it than AT&T and Verizon have been, with the result that if you have 5G in Canada, it's consistently a little faster than 4G.
It's like barely, it's so much. I mean, I want to get to that a bit later because like, I just want to use you and this platform to complain.
Oh, sure.
Please. but it's not an inspiring rollout in any shape or form.
Okay. So here's what happened in Canada. Okay. So remember how I said that Verizon and AT&T had to reuse existing bits of 4G so that they could get a 5 icon on their phones. Well, the Canadian carriers had some 4G channels that they weren't using yet, unused 4G channels, and they threw 5G on that. So it's additive to your existing 4G experience because the channels hadn't been used yet, but essentially they're 4G channels, and had the carriers used 4G on them, you would have roughly the same performance in 4G. There's right. nothing about the 5G-ness of them that is particularly notable.
Yeah, the 5G-ness is a little lackluster, I think, in general. I want to bring it back and talk a little bit high level, because back in early 2020, before the pandemic, the last event I believe you went to, as well as the one that I went to in person, was the Galaxy S20 launch. And that was the first device to launch with the Qualcomm X55 modem. It was the first one that, at least in Canada, coincided with a big 5G launch. And it was the first series of phones outside of like Motorola's 5G Moto mod on Verizon that you could take for granted would work across most carriers in the US. And from then till now, a year, just under 10 months later, we have a situation where most people in the US have access to, quote, nationwide 5G. And yet I still don't know why anybody would want this technology. I don't know what it gives me that 4G doesn't. And largely, it does feel still like the carriers and the vendors and the network operators and the manufacturers, they're all lying to us. They're all just telling us a story. And I want to be wrong about this, but I'd like to know your perspective because you're closer to this. What have we gained in the last year through 5G's slow but steady rollout?
A lot of what we all have to remember about G transitions, and I've been in this business a long time. I saw 2G to 3G, I saw 3G to 4G, and often the transformative power that comes from a G transition doesn't come right when the networks are launched. It right. comes 2 or 3 years later because you need time for developers all to get access to those networks and to figure out through use what the new solution will be. And then with 3G, you got widespread mobile web. And with 4G, you got Snapchat and Instagram and YouTube and TikTok and all that. And this is held back even further with 5G in the US because, as we just established, the stuff that we call 5G in the US and Canada isn't notably 5G-ish. It's really just bits and pieces of 4G with a number 5 tacked on. So once we actually get real 5G networks, and I think the first one I would say is legit in North America is this T-Mobile ultra capacity mid-band network. Verizon's millimeter wave network is wonderful, but actually we should get back to that later. And let's put a pin in that. Just holler Super Bowl at some point. Once we have actual notable 5G networks covering enough people, then you get the ball rolling, and then wild things happen a year later, and then the whole world transforms, and then, you know, everybody, and then there's some crazy new use of mobile technology.
Right.
But it's all been held back by the fact that, at least in North America, the 5G networks just generally haven't been installed on the right airwaves.
And I guess that ambiguity, that the fact that the experience is so different depending on where you are in the country, is why you wrote a story a few weeks back called Why Every U.S. Carrier is, quote, winning fastest 5G awards. And I'd like you to walk us through what that means, because when I think of 5G in the U.S., I think of the three approaches, or I guess the four until T-Mobile and Sprint merged, approaches to rolling this out. And Verizon's millimeter wave network, the ultra wideband network that carries a huge amount of data, very short distances, mm-hmm. was the game changer. And then we've seen follow-ups that it hasn't quite been as effective in many ways. But when these three different reports came out kind of one after the other, every carrier claimed victory in some way. And it's hard to know how that's possible. So walk us through exactly what happened there.
Yeah, it basically just has to do with the fact that everyone was using slightly different timing and slightly different methodologies. T-Mobile is rolling out this mid-band network very fast right now. And so the longer you wait between the time you test and the time you publish, the worse T-Mobile looks, because T-Mobile is rolling it out so fast that T-Mobile from 3 months ago looks much worse than T-Mobile now.
Right.
With Verizon, the more Verizon millimeter wave you get into your data set and the less Verizon nationwide you get into your data set, the better Verizon looks. And so the design of your study, where you go, what cities you go to, whether you're indoors or outdoors, whether you're using crowdsourced or drive test, about balancing that Verizon really good millimeter wave versus Verizon really bad nationwide, that really affects Verizon's score right now. And AT&T, because their 5G is basically 4G, and their 4G is really good, they tend to give a much more constant or consistent rating. But so you see these different ratings organizations through the question of when they tested and exactly where they tested, they end up coming up with different results. And then there's also the fact of what they're testing and the fact that Verizon always wins RootMetrics reports, because RootMetrics factors in calling and texting, and Verizon's really, really good at that.
Even today, they still have that lead.
Verizon is really good at calling and texting.
That's so funny. It's like these legacy categories that nobody really cares about anymore, or you can just take for granted.
Hey, man, voice calls are up this year. Way up.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. Jerry, you wrote something that's going to be published later today as we're recording around millimeter wave, around what people have gotten wrong about it, what it's actually useful for. And I want you two to kind of chat about that, because one thing, Sasha, you wrote earlier this year was all about Verizon's push to bring millimeter wave to the home. More people mm-hmm. are obviously staying home, and the rollout of 5G is happening invisibly because nobody's traveling anywhere, right? Nobody's able to take advantage of these broader networks unless you were not covered properly before. And I think this idea of bringing ultra-fast 5G to the home as a, you know, in areas where they don't have copper or don't have fiber is really interesting to me. So I guess, Sasha, like, what's the status of 5G to the home at this point? Who's doing it best? And is that something we can see, we can expect to be a bit more ubiquitous in a couple of years?
I mean, this is a situation where, and I would really like to hear Jerry's thoughts on what the appropriate uses of millimeter wave are. This is another situation where the carriers seem to be inexplicably flubbing it. Verizon has said many times that they intend to roll out home 5G in the cities where they have mobile 5G. They've made a deal with a company called Pivotal Comware that does these boxes that go on the inside of your window to help get the 5G into the house. But they're rolling it out painfully slowly, and they're making it not available to very many people, even in the cities where they say it's available. T-Mobile has pledged to offer 5G home internet. In fact, I think it might have been a binding pledge as part of their agreement to buy Sprint.
Yeah, but it was.
Okay. Well, we haven't seen that yet.
Yeah.
So 5G home, I can tell you up and down why millimeter wave is a great technology to deliver internet to homes, even relatively rural homes. When you're going point to point, millimeter wave beams can be very focused and can be very individual. And so you can use them to replace the expensive wiring that you would need to get that last quarter mile from the road to the farmhouse. But nobody's actually doing this. So that's kind of a gap between the technology and the implementation.
That's my biggest... I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
but
please.
When you started talking about beamforming, that is what I am most interested about, in how the spectrum between 28 gigahertz and 100 gigahertz can beamform so much better than other spectrum. I have an electrical engineering background, but I still can't wrap my head around how a certain frequency can be better beamformed than others. But I keep hearing it, so it must be true.
I mean, I don't have an electrical engineering background, but the best I've heard is that it does have to do with how small and tight these waves are.
Hmm.
And the fact that the waves are so small and tight, they function better in tightly controlled beams than larger waves, which tend to spread broadcast and fuzz out around the edges.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, so beamforming, absolutely key to 5G home internet, which we would all like to see and don't quite understand why it isn't there. But also, I've been talking to people recently who point out that the real uses for millimeter wave are in things like crowded sports stadiums, live music concert halls, convention centers, university lecture halls, lots of places where lots and lots of people get together in really tight, crowded circumstances and all have to use their phones and then find that their phones or devices aren't connecting because the network is overloaded. And what do all of those things have in common?
I mean, they're trying to use more bandwidth than is available.
Yes, but they're also all things we haven't been able to do for the past year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a big, you know, kink in the plan there.
Exactly. So you end up with a situation where I think that the uses of millimeter wave that the carriers most could show off are in places where we are not allowed to go for reasons of public health. I know that AT&T and Verizon spent millions upon millions wiring up football and basketball stadiums, for instance. And Verizon really wants to show off this complicated multi-camera, high bandwidth video streaming thing for the Super Bowl, where they're going to have to keep the stadium two-thirds empty. So it's this kind of painful, sad, pitiful, ironic situation where, like, millimeter wave can apply to and improve a lot of the joyous events of life, which we cannot experience.
For now.
That just sounds so bleak, but it's true.
Yeah. So, Jerry, what have you been thinking about the uses of millimeter wave and the potential uses of 5G?
I see millimeter wave. I understand its potential as let's call it the end point. You use a mesh system of small sites, and you get millimeter wave to crowded places, maybe even an entire municipal area like Manhattan. And as you said, sports stadiums. I know they plan the National Mall in Washington, D.C. is going to be a huge millimeter wave site. My biggest issue is I understand the electrical theory. I know that these chunks of bandwidth are very wide and can transmit data extremely quickly, but not very far. If I'm remembering right, even at just 26 gigahertz, which is the lowest radio spectrum that they would call millimeter wave, can only transmit data 1 kilometer, slightly less than 1 kilometer, in open air and sunny conditions. I can't get my head around a way to handle all the backhaul for a nationwide network in a country the size of the U.S. or Canada or China or Russia. I understand why the Netherlands and South Korea have excellent millimeter wave 5G.
They don't. They don't.
Oh, they don't?
No.
What, are they using mid-band?
They're using mid-band. Part of why the U.S. is in such a weird situation is that we were first on millimeter wave. All the other countries went to mid-band first.
Ah, that makes much more sense.
There is some millimeter wave in Japan, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's Japan, but it's very limited, and it's nothing like the kind of rollout Verizon was attempting.
Mm-hmm.
But so, Jerry, what you're saying about the backhaul issue, I wanted to call out some of the stuff that's coming soon in 5G, because that does help. And some of the kind of answering some of your earlier questions about when is 5G going to be transformative. So 5G is, what 5G is run by an organization called the 3GPP, which is this global consortium of basically everybody in wireless. And every 2 years, they have a feature update for their network standards called a release. And the first release of 5G was release 15. And release 16 just got closed and is starting to be implemented now. And some things that are in release 16, which are really important, are one of them is using 5G for wireless backhaul, using the same 5G equipment that you use to connect to N units also for wireless backhaul. So you get to a situation where, Jerry, you are able to put together these millimeter wave mesh networks where the millimeter wave units talk to the end user, but also talk to each other and also use the millimeter wave as backhaul. And then you also get, in release 16, you get something called NRU, or 5G over unlicensed. And that lets them use the unlicensed spectrum, such as the 5 and 6 gigahertz Wi-Fi spectrum, where available, to enhance 5G networks. And then you also get in release 16, release 16 is full of fun stuff, you also get in release 16 network slicing and private networks. And that's where a lot of businesses are excited about 5G, because this is something that is impossible to do, as far as I know, with Wi-Fi, and impossible to do with 4G, which is essentially slice off parts of the bandwidth for guaranteed quality of service for various uses. And a lot of businesses are very excited to be able to get some kind of guaranteed quality of service for industrial purposes on 5G, and that's part of release 16.
When you say slicing off bandwidth, how much bandwidth are we talking about? Are we talking about 5 megahertz, 10, or like literally fractions of a megahertz for like a small area? Like, or are you isolating a specific amount of that frequency? Like, if I want to, if an industrial complex takes is the size of like, you know, a few city blocks, you can literally keep anybody connected to that tower from gaining access to it unless you have permission. Or am I interpreting that wrong?
So, I mean, you can already do that. You can already say, you know, only people with the appropriate permission can use my tower. This is a lot higher tech than just slicing off, say, 701 to 704 megahertz and saying it's for public safety. This is math in the computers running the base stations, which enable them to prioritize certain users over other users.
Right. So it's a very high, it's a extremely complex version of the QoS settings that you can manipulate today on your routers. You can,
right.
If you have an amplify system with, you know, and you understand networking and you apply VLANs to particular incoming traffic, you can basically isolate anything you want within that network.
Right. And to some extent, the wireless carriers do that already. I mean, there's, you know, as you know, they all downgrade your video quality, but
sure do.
This lets them do it in a much more productive fashion based on who the user is and what the user needs and the class of, for instance, you could offer a slice that has really low latency, but also really low bandwidth. And then another slice where the latency doesn't matter so much, but you can guarantee 100 megabits. And so there's a lot of, with network slicing in 5G, there's just a lot of ways to customize the network to what a particular business or industrial user needs.
And this is particularly important for industrial use. As a personal example, I know somebody that works at a factory that produces cardboard. They want to connect all their equipment together for a central control station, but because of the electrical interference all that equipment creates, that's almost impossible to do over 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi.
Right. So I don't know about the electrical engineering details of that, but that might be possible to do using beamforming at a much higher frequency.
He is under the impression that, yes, as soon as I think it's Verizon is going to set it up for their facility, that they will have exactly what they wanted.
Right. And so this is, to some extent, this is what T-Mobile has always proclaimed is the layer cake theory of 5G. And this is, if I was the god of 5G, the way these networks would be built out is you have millimeter wave in your factory, in your lecture hall, in your convention center. You're not trying to blanket a whole city with millimeter wave. The city is blanketed with 200 megahertz of midband, and that's all most people need. Maybe you're also using millimeter wave to deliver to a special home internet to homes point to point. And then you have rural areas that are blanketed with relatively low band, 600 or 700 megahertz, but are also, once again, point to point, could be served by high power millimeter wave WISPs. Because Jerry, do you have WISPs out there? How do they work out there?
I don't think so.
Define what that is, Sasha, just for people who don't know.
A WISP is a wireless internet service provider. These have existed for decades. They provide home internet service, usually using the microwave bands, I believe.
Yeah.
To people in rural areas who can't get cabling. And it's been a small but very good and redoubtable industry. And I have definitely heard of talk of 5G improving the fates of that industry.
I used to work for a company before I was in tech, in media, who made the modems and the backhaul infrastructure, the tower infrastructure, like the antennas, for these WISPs. So they would They would build it for both mid-band, like 3.5 gigahertz, 3 to 3.5 gigahertz, as well as microwave. So in the, up to the 50s and 60 gigahertz range. It's a company called Redline Communications based up here. And, you know, this was well before LTE was even rolled out. So this was back in 2010, 2011. And for countries, especially in the Middle East, the countries with their biggest clients were in the Middle East, where you could do point to point, like big, you know, high tower to high tower with very little loss, because there were no trees, there was never any rain. You know, it's basically just a clear hop from one building to the other. You could essentially build a backhaul network, very high speed, with a single fiber node going into one of these buildings and then hopping between them for a few, you know, 100 kilometers, and end up being able to then put a bunch of multipath towers on the top of the other building, and then blanket that service down to homes in that region that have no fiber, no copper, no telephone, nothing. And it was remarkable, the stability of those networks, given the fact that they were all done wirelessly using essentially microwave hops. It was crazy.
And see, I live on the edge of that area. It's not been too long ago that every company was funded by the government under an older rural broadband initiative, that they ran copper to all the homes and businesses. Yes, copper, not fiber. I know it's crazy.
It still works,
stupid.
Jerry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, I'm sure if I were to drive 50 miles further west from here, I would find, you know, an industrial complex that needed, you know, to use WISP technology to stay connected.
So in my newsletter this week, I basically had a lot of fun annoying Elon Musk fans.
Thank you.
As you
because,
do.
what's at the center of that, though, was the crazed the crazed messianic fervor over Starlink, which is this LEO satellite ISP that one of his companies is putting up. And now you can go read the newsletter. To make a long story short, Starlink probably can't serve more than 1 million users in the US because of the capacity of the satellites. So it's going to end up disappointing a lot of people. But the controversy at the heart of all of these angry comments was just how desperate people are for better internet options.
Yes.
For better home and work internet options. Whether they are, you know, the rural people are the loudest, but the city people are also having some pretty big problems. And they're crazy about Starlink because Starlink is promoting itself. It's what they hear about, but there just is this painful desperation need for better home internet options in North America.
Okay. So I want to move away from the home internet discussion a little bit, because I want to refocus us on mobile and cellular. And I want to talk about the C-band auction that is taking place right now that just finished its first phase. And I want to talk about the new FCC under the acting chairwoman, Jessica Rosenworcel. And I just want to talk a little bit about where we're at, because you had mentioned earlier that the FCC under Trump, Sasha, was a little bit ineffective in many ways. But in one of the ways, it kind of bungled the 5G rollout, the spectrum rollout. So C-band, what is it? Why is it important? Why have carriers spent over $80 billion so far? And once it's all said and done, what do we get out of it?
So it turns out that for reasons of physics, the best frequencies to distribute 5G on are generally between 3 and 7 gigahertz. And that's because you can get enough reach that you don't need to put a tower every, you don't need to put a panel every 1600 feet. And you can get wide enough channel sizes that it makes some sort of difference from 4G. And most of the rest of the world realized this and initially put 5G on this area called the C-band, which is between, it's in the 3-4 gigahertz range. However, here in the US, the C-band was being used by some private satellite companies who had gotten licenses to the spectrum for free all the way back in the 1970s and 80s. And the Trump FCC was not terribly effective at convincing those satellite companies to give up their spectrum. But eventually, they came around to an understanding of how to auction off 280 megahertz of this prime spectrum. And the auction just completed. We don't know who won yet. We'll know who won what at the end of February. But the deal is that this is probably Verizon and AT&T are each going to get at least 100 megahertz, which is around double what you are currently around double the bandwidth of what you're currently accessing on your phone at any given time. At least,
and that's
double.
Nationwide or just in particular areas?
And it's nationwide.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And from what we've seen with 3.5 gigahertz modeling, you need to put a tower maybe every half a mile. So not ideal for the rural areas, but for the suburbs and exurbs of America, they can make it work.
Got it.
And so we get on the C-band, we have the bandwidth to really offer a network that's different from 4G, and we have the range to actually build it. And AT&T and Verizon were desperate for this. And so as a result, $80 billion. Now, the way that it's going to be rolled out is a little odd because of the fact that the satellite companies are still using it and they need to get off of it or clear it. They're clearing it in phases. And so you're going to find that the first 100 megahertz nationwide get cleared at the end of this year. But then the other 180 megahertz get cleared at the end of 2023. And so one of the debates out around and between me and my other Spectrum Geek friends is who got the early 100 megahertz. Because whoever got that early chunk of C-band, whether it's Verizon or AT&T, and it's probably Verizon, is going to get a big jump on the other one in terms of successfully rolling out a good 5G network that makes a difference. And I really do think it is going to make a difference, which is part of why, just to get to the fact this is, an Android podcast, which is part of why I'm paying a lot of attention to which phones right now have C-band and saying that if you were interested in a better 5G experience across cities, suburbs, exurbs, maybe not the super rural areas, you want to pay attention to which phones have C-band because it's coming online next year.
And you had a bit of a scoop this week when you discovered that the FCC documents were updated for the Pixel 5 and the LG Wing to show that those phones sold in the US do support C-band. And those are the third and fourth series or third and fourth phones after the iPhone 12 and the Galaxy S21, right?
Yeah, and there will be a lot more this year, but those are the third and fourth. And something I want to ask you guys is, do you think, does LG updating the Wing for C-band, which is a network that, isn't going to be a big deal until next year, does that change your equation, your personal equation in how you judge the LG is getting out of the mobile business rumors?
No, not at all. Jerry may have a different take on this, but LG is, a company that makes its decisions well in advance. Like its lead up to these decisions is probably weeks, months, if not years. And I'm guessing, they've been developing the Wing for 3 or 4 years now. If it gets out of the mobile business, or at least gets out of most of it, the rumors are that they're going to sell off part of the business and only build flagships for one or two markets. I don't think this has any correlation with whether they get out of the business. I think the wing they acknowledged was an experiment, and maybe mm-hmm. because of that, they just were able to, you know, to splash a bit more money where needed. But mm-hmm. In terms of like the process of getting C-band support online, it's not like they had to make any hardware changes. It was there. It just needed to be updated with a software patch. So why do you think that happens, right? Why does Google release a Pixel 5 with this nascent C-band support and then update it later on? Like, what is the purpose of that?
It's also going to need a separate and well-designed antenna, correct, Sasha?
So I believe that C-band can be handled by a lot of current hardware.
Right. It's still mid-band.
It's still mid-band. I don't know if there's a specific C-band antenna, Jerry.
Because that was my only question about hearing the rumor. And I also would agree with Daniel. LG is going to turn into a boutique brand, mm-hmm. let's say, mm-hmm. like Sony. Sony makes very expensive high-end phones.
I mean, they are already
customers.
Let's be honest.
For customers who love Sony products, I think that's what LG is going to turn into.
But Dan, to answer your question of why are the companies doing it this way, it's because doing the lab testing to get your FCC clearance paperwork is terribly, terribly expensive. And it goes up with every band and feature you test. So companies may not want to initially test and get clearance for capabilities that they don't need immediately. They may draw that out and do some changes with the FCC later to take advantage of cheaper rates from testing facilities or new equipment at the testing facilities or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It has to do with the bureaucracy and the expense of getting the FCC clearance, basically.
Got it. Okay. So we're getting to the end of our segment. So I want to give you a bit of some rapid fire questions, and you can answer them as quickly as you can. All right. Let's try this out.
I want to give you one hard one at the end.
Okay, perfect. All right. Mm-hmm. Samsung and MediaTek have launched millimeter wave compatible 5G modems. Will that impact Qualcomm's market share in the US?
In a small way, but not a big way. The weird agreement that Samsung and Qualcomm have to not sell Exynos devices at the flagship level in the US still appears to hold. I'm not quite sure what demonic scroll inked in blood, created that, but it's still around. You're going to see some MediaTek devices in the lower and mid range. Absolutely, it's not going to crush Qualcomm. It's not going to kill Qualcomm. Qualcomm is more afraid right now of Apple doing its own modems in 2-3 years than either Samsung or MediaTek.
Fair enough. Okay, next. What the hell is happening with Ericsson and Huawei? Because somehow Ericsson is supporting Huawei in Sweden. And is it because Ericsson is a big customer of China Mobile? Or is there something else nefarious going on?
Well, I mean, a lot of these companies, and you see this with Qualcomm too, a lot of these companies want to have markets in China. They want to sell stuff to China. And China, the Chinese government, has made it clear that the government can control the presence of foreign companies in its market, and your opinion about Huawei may control whether or not you are allowed to sell stuff to China.
Got it. Makes sense. So the Snapdragon 888, as everybody said, was all about China. It was all about appeasing what the customers, both their end users, people buying phones, but also the Vivos, Oppos, Xiaomi's of the world, and I guess Lenovo as well, want out of a Qualcomm flagship chip.
Yeah, I mean, come on, it's called the 888. You're not going to call something the 888 if it isn't, meant to appeal to the Chinese consumer.
I picked that up instantly. Yeah.
Okay.
It's crazy.
In your testing, so you tested the Snapdragon 888 powered Galaxy S21 series. You said it got up to beyond 3 gigabits on Verizon. What else have you found demonstrably better about cellular performance with the new series of Snapdragon modems versus the older X55?
I actually have not seen a lot, and that's just because the U.S. carriers haven't put the features in place yet that take advantage of the new modems. The biggest deal about the new modem is new forms of carrier aggregation between 4G and 5G, and that's stuff that AT&T and Rogers are both going to implement, and AT&T has not quite implemented it yet, so we haven't seen the change in performance yet. Rogers, I'm not sure if they've turned it on yet, but you should definitely check.
I don't know, because I'm on Telus, and it's a pain in the ass to switch these days, but I would like to, because Rogers keeps pitching me. They are the first Canadian carrier to launch a standalone network. I know that T-Mobile is in the U.S. That's my next question. What is the difference to me and you and the people listening when a carrier switches from a non-standalone network to a standalone network? And let's not necessarily go into the definition of standalone, but maybe you can kind of give a little bit of an idea.
So standalone, as you the user, standalone gives you lower latency and better 5G coverage in exchange for less speed. Because you've cut loose the 4G network that the 5G network was attached to, you can't add on the 4G and 5G channels, so you have somewhat less speed, but you aren't being dragged down by 4G's latency, and you aren't beholden to the 4G cell shape. 5G has slightly better propagation at the same frequencies. So, you gain coverage, you gain latency, you lose some speed because you don't have those 4G channels anymore.
All right, last question from me, and then Jared can ask his harder question. What are you most excited about in 2021 and beyond with regards to 5G? And I'm thinking use cases and or technology that comes in the phones through the releases themselves.
Mm-hmm. So I really want to see us honestly get out of our houses and be able to put ourselves in places where these extremely high bandwidth uses become relevant. For instance, the millimeter wave use case of being at a music concert and being able to summon multiple angles from the concert on your device is really compelling, and that is a millimeter wave thing. And there's very similar stuff to be talked about with sports. I really want to see the home ISPs disrupted, and that very well might happen later this year if T-Mobile actually follows through on its promises. And I want to see developers be able to get out there and start developing the weird, unexpected applications that we can't predict yet. And that's not going to happen until this pandemic ends and we can get out of our darn houses and experience the world as it's meant to be experienced. I'm a mobile guy. I've been doing mobile for 15 years. And one of the reasons is because I like to be out of my house. I like to be out in the world. I like to experience technology out in the world. I want those augmented reality glasses where everybody's LinkedIn card appears above their heads as I pass them on the street because I am getting old and I can't remember what people's names are anymore. That's a great 5G use case. I want the augmented reality travel guide, which translates every sign in Slovenian on the Slovenian street. That's a great 5G use case. But none of it's going to happen until we get out of our darn houses. So let's get this pandemic done with. Let's get our vaccines. Let's wear 3 masks if we have to. And then let's get out there and make the world alight with brilliant technological weirdness.
Beautiful.
I just want to say the security and privacy nerd deep down inside me just died after hearing what you said about LinkedIn cards above everybody's head and auto-translating across the cloud. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be such a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
All right, Jerry, what's your question?
This is Sasha, I'm going to tell you up front, if your answer is, I'm not sure, that's fine. I have asked everybody who has ever said the words 5G or typed the words 5G. This, where I live, T-Mobile just switched everything to 600.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, these phones I had that were just fine all of a sudden now say 5G on them.
Yeah, they work the same. Yeah,
they work the same for the most part, unless it snows. We have had two bad snowstorms this year, and both times my mobile internet over 600 has just died. On the Nexus 5, there's an application that will shut off the 600 band, or so it claims to. I know somebody that's tried that, and they said that their
Pixel
network
5,
speeds...
Not Nexus 5.
Pixel 5, yes.
Okay, just making
that,
sure.
That their next... Their, at network speed has returned to normal. Is there anything inherent with the, you know, sub 6 5G that weather could cause such, and I'm talking drastic. I'm talking, you know, 15, 20 megabits down and 10 megabits up to 3G speeds, unusable in today's web. Is there anything that could make that happen?
I mean, there's nothing that strikes me about 5G-ness, but I'm wondering if you're turning off the 600 band, does your phone then switch towers? And then do you end up connecting to a different tower that is in a more advantageous location for you given the snow?
That's possible. I don't have a Nexus 5, so I couldn't try that myself. Somebody else tried that, and I didn't think to ask them to look at what tower they connected.
One thing I've noticed on all of the carriers' networks is that because the carriers are all super enthusiastic about 5G, their networks privilege your phone going to 5G, even if there is a closer or better 4G alternative.
Ah.
And so I haven't seen this happening this badly with T-Mobile, but I'm not in a rural area. And I know T-Mobile can be really dodgy in rural areas.
Yes.
So, but I have seen it happening with Verizon. And I'm thinking maybe T-Mobile's network wants you to be on 5G really badly and has you in a 5G sort of edge case with some 600 tower, but you're really closer to like a 700 tower, and turning off that 600 bumps you back to the closer location or different angle up or down a hill that helps get around the snow.
Okay, at least now I know what to look for, and thank you for letting me know I'm not insane.
You're not. I mean, because, I can't say whether or not you're not, well, but you're not about this.
Well, no, I know I see this. I see this. This is happening. This shouldn't be happening. I don't understand. So I finally found somebody who didn't just flat out say, I don't know, maybe you're insane.
I mean, yeah, you are, but that's besides the point. I work with you every day. That's why I love you.
I mean, wireless RF is dark sorcery, okay? It is absolutely dark sorcery.
Well, Sasha, every week we end our show with a segment that I stole from Pop Culture Happy Hour called What's Making Us Happy? And it's basically exactly that. I ask everybody on the call, what's making us happy? So it doesn't have to be tech-related, but it can be anything that is just putting a smile on your face right now. So I didn't ask you beforehand because I wanted to put you on the spot, but give me something in your life right now that is bringing you joy.
Well, did you know that yesterday was National Tater Tot Day?
No, I did not.
Oh my God, so, my thing just changed.
So yeah, yesterday was National Tater Tot Day. I did a big tater tot spread for the family, multiple sauces, multiple vegetables, you know, kind of a dipping experience. You could combine them. It was definitely a step ahead in, and I appreciate a tater tot even on a day-to-day basis.
Beautiful. I love that. I think a good tater tot, there's nothing better. The flip side, conversely, is that a bad tater tot, one that's been refrigerated or is just cold and congealed,
freeze-burned tater tot,
is horrible. Terrible.
And then, of course, the other thing that's making me happy right now, because I do need to self-promote, is that I now get to vent in a spicy newsletter.
Yes, please tell us about that.
Yes. So I have a newsletter that now goes out on Sundays at the moment. It'll stay weekly. That day of the week might change, which has a column about 5G and some of what I think are the top stories of the week with my own take on each one. And it is guaranteed to be stronger opinions than I put on my regular stories on PC Mag, where I try to stay with some equanimity. And you can sign up for that. It's called Sasha Segan's Race to 5G. If you just Google PC Mag newsletters, you will get the sign up page.
Excellent.
Good. I've already signed up for it, I think, twice on both email addresses. So
Thank you.
Just to juice those numbers for you, buddy.
So what's making you guys happy?
Well, we are okay. So we're going to hold that for the next one because we have a second section. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and speak to a friend of ours to talk about Stadia. So I wanted to ask you, Sasha, you can either stay and chat about Stadia and what's happened on that side of the world, or you can feel free to drop off if you want. Either way, I'm okay with it.
Oh, I know you want to sit and talk about Stadia.
Speaking of Stadia, I actually have a deadline. I've got to go write about some of those Verizon 5G stadiums. So
okay, fair enough.
Thank you guys for having me.
Nice play on words. Yeah, thanks. Sasha, thank you.
Nice meeting you.
I really, really thank you for being here. It's always awesome to talk to you and nerding out with you. So we'll talk to you again very soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. Podcasts are a small business. When we're talking to business owners, we get it 100%. And when it comes to hiring, every single hire needs to fit just right. Our team is tiny. One wrong move could destroy us. And that's why we're telling you about Indeed. Indeed.com is the hiring site that helps you find quality candidates with Indeed Instant Match. Indeed searches through the millions of resumes in their database to help show you great candidates instantly. So you can do the part you really need faster, meeting and hiring great people. Unlike some hiring sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a quality shortlist faster. With Indeed, there are no long-term contracts. You can pause your account at any time, and you only pay for what you need. With Instant Match, you see a list of great candidates with zero wait. And Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest. Do you want your quality shortlist fast? You need Indeed right now. Our listeners get a free $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. That's Indeed.com/ACP. This is Indeed's best offer anywhere. Get a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. Offer valid through March 31st. Terms and conditions apply. All right, so we're back from break and we are shifting gears. I mean, I don't know if it's 180, 360, we'll just say 270 degrees here. We're going to speak with our buddy, David Jagno. David, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm doing pretty well.
Good. Thanks for being here on short notice. This is a weird one because my initial vision for this week's show was to go all in on 5G and just talk about it. And then Stadia exploded and I was like, okay, who do I know who can talk about this this BS like very confidently? And you came to mind because you are our relatively new freelancer for Android Central covering Stadia, but you are a senior editor over at Upload VR. So you cover all of the kind of emerging platforms as they are, as they're coming up. And if you don't already know what happened with Stadia, I guess maybe David, you can just jump right in and like give us the 30-second rundown of literally like the day after you published your February 2021 re-review saying that this is a great service and that it has a very bright future, something pretty major happened.
That was some excellent timing on my part. Yeah, pretty funny. So that published on Sunday and then Monday morning Google posts a blog on the Stadia website stating that they are going to wind down Stadia Games and Entertainment, functionally closing their internal development studio, which recently acquired Typhoon Studio, another developer that just released a game on Monday. I think the same day they announced closing the studio. So they're great at timing things as well. And they also announced that Jade Raymond, who was brought on, I believe, 2.5-3 years ago at this point, was also leaving the company. And there's no indication of where she's going, why she left, for if there's any other reason, or even really what she was working on, you know, all these years. So there's a big grenade got dropped into the middle of Stadia at the beginning of this week. And I would say the community is still coming to terms with what that means.
So the timeline here is Monday morning, this blog post goes out. Jade Raymond announces she's leaving. 150 people, mostly developers, will be losing their jobs. The two studios are shutting down. SG&E, Stadia Games and Entertainment, is no longer an entity. And then all the speculation starts, right? Immediately people are wondering, will Stadia shut down? Is this the death knell that so many other Google services have been handed prematurely? Or is Stadia merely doubling down, I guess, on third-party partners? And we've seen the early signs of that, where EA is now coming on board. There's Madden 21. FIFA 21 is coming out soon. The company released its first channel with Ubisoft Plus. And we're seeing that the technology is now stable, as you wrote in your review. And the developers are now getting, and publishers are getting more used to putting stuff out on the platform. And is this just merely the natural evolution for a company that didn't really understand games in the first place and didn't understand the investment needed in first-party production of games?
I think that is the most positive outlook that we could hope for, and I think it's possible that that is what's going on. I think that's what they want people to assume, and that's kind of the phrasing that I got from the blog post. There was a lot of language about focusing more on third parties, and I think they use a term like reinvesting in the platform or something like that. And I know that for me, just personally, anecdotally, all of the best Stadia games have been third party. They haven't really done anything with their first party investments yet, other than publish a couple of things like Outcasters, which went straight to Stadia Pro, and Submerged, which was kind of underwhelming, and then A Journey to the Savage Planet, which just came out with some Stadia exclusive features. But up until now, there hasn't really been a whole lot going on. And so those 150 developers were kind of left wondering what exactly were they working on. And I think the blog post mentioned that they would have the opportunity to change to other teams internally at Google, whatever that means. I'm not really sure, you know, how many game developers and, you know, artists and stuff are going to want to work on other non-gaming projects at Google, but I guess there's still potential for that. There's a lot of uncertainty, and I think with, you know, Amazon Luna on the, you know, horizon now, still in early access, but certainly gaining momentum, you know, they have a channel-based model as well, rather than being able to purchase games outright like you can on Stadia. There's a lot of questions. Like the Stadia Twitter account is basically just repeating the same line to every single person, saying, oh, you can still play your games on Stadia, but they don't answer the question of what happens if Stadia shuts down. And I think they just don't want to have to say you will lose all your games, because that's obviously what would happen. Yeah. So I know that historically Google shuts down a lot of things, you know, prematurely, like you said, but I do think you could also make the argument that paid services generally tend to do well, at least in terms of, you know, longevity. So maybe that's, you know, silver lining here, I guess.
You know, I have to agree with you. I think this is the only way Stadia can survive is to... Google is like me if I forget to take my Adderall. You know, they don't know what they're doing. And let's be honest, they probably know more than it appears, but on the surface, they're just scatterbrained. Google is not a gaming studio. I don't know who in the company thought, hey, you know what? Tomorrow we can be a gaming studio if we just hire 100 people. But that's not going to work. And I agree, the best games on Stadia are all third-party games. And I don't see that ever changing. And if Stadia wants to survive, they need to invest in getting newer and more third-party games and stop trying to pretend that they're the next, I'll say Ubisoft, because they're the first company that came to mind.
Right. But what Stadia did, at least has, it's not a old service, but what it's tried to do with a few third-party titles is get an exclusive launch entirely, or a relatively lengthy exclusivity window that would put the game on Stadia for a while before it rolls out to other platforms. We saw it
with Outcasters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did that with Embers. It's done that with Baldur's Gate 3. So there are a few titles.
I don't think that's necessary. I really don't. I don't think there's enough value for Google in that situation to spend the time and money to try to make that happen. And I say that as a gamer. I want to play a new game that comes out. I am not going to change platforms if I can get some sort of extra cosmetic, or I get to play, you know, 15 days earlier. I'm not going to install new software and pay money to a different publisher. I will just swear under my breath and wait until it comes on Steam.
Right. But this is what I'm trying to understand. So by Google essentially removing any differentiation other than the technology stack, we are left with a reality where Google can, as David said, continue to try to get money through selling games, where it's a pretty low margin business, or Stadia Pro, which is a $10 a month subscription where you get higher quality streaming, you get 3 free games a month as long as you continue to be a member, you get a few other perks, and that's a little bit of money. But if there is no reason for a PlayStation or Xbox user to switch to Stadia as its primary console, then it's kind of left in this nether region of why does it exist in the first place? And some of the speculation is that Google is shutting down SG&E so that it can focus on white labeling its technology and selling it to publishers to launch their own cloud services. And we saw this with Nintendo launching a cloud-based version of what was the game last year?
Control and Hitman.
Right, Control was the first one. So that is a streamed version of the game, but it's not using a cloud vendor that we know of. It's not a very well-known company. And Google, with its mature technology stack, it's been building on live forever, and now Stadia, I think that makes the most amount of sense. David, what's your take on that as kind of the future of Stadia?
I think that it makes sense in terms of that for them, that would probably be the most profitable path, just in the short term. But I think that if you look at what Microsoft's doing, they're playing more of the long game, where they know that building out a user base of subscribers that are using their platform is, you know, in the long term going to end up being better. And I think Google has the resources to do something like that, where they try to treat Stadia as its own platform. And I think I don't know if they need timed exclusives from third parties necessarily. I'm not too sure if that's really going to be the best avenue, because I think a lot of the time whenever I've had people try Stadia, that they, you know, that's the tricky thing, is just getting someone to try it, because there's so much misconception about the technology, about, you know, how well it works and if your internet's good enough. And I think, you know, even just on Twitter a couple of days ago, I had someone in my mentions telling me, oh, I had no idea that there wasn't a console. They thought you had to buy a box to stream from. And there's still so much education required around it. And, you know, I'm not sure if fragmenting stuff even further by saying, oh, you know, you can sign up for the 2K streaming service or the Ubisoft service or the Bethesda streaming service, or I don't know. I think that would be a negative thing for most gamers. They wouldn't want as that many destinations. It happens on PC already with the Epic Game Store and Steam and Uplay and Origin, and doing the same thing with streaming services might, you know, be even worse.
I do want to say it, what, you know, that scenario scares me a little bit, because Google does have some sort of black magic voodoo video compression that they use. We see it with Duo calling, and we see it with Stadia. Compare side by side the bandwidth you use from Stadia or, you know, Xbox or Nvidia. You use less bandwidth if you're using Stadia. They, you know, that's proprietary, and that's very valuable. And I could see them just saying, screw making the gaming service. Let's just sell the technology. And I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I don't either. And, you know, part of that, I try to make sure I can divorce my personal interest and, you know, enjoyment of a platform in terms of, you know, I was a founder of Stadia. I, you know, signed up immediately. I've loved it ever since launch, really. I acknowledge its faults, and it has plenty of them, and it's came a long way. But, you know, as someone that enjoys games, I want Stadia to continue. And I think a big reason for that is just because of the flexibility of, you know, the different platforms. And that's something that none of the other streaming services really have, is the ability to play on, you know, TV with Chromecast, on a web browser, on a tablet, right, on a phone, and have that all seamless, connected, same save, all that stuff is just so, so simple. And I think one of the avenues they could take, and this is something they've done a tiny bit with, and this is something that Ubisoft has been doing, is everything on Stadia, in my opinion, needs to have cross saves. That yes. needs to be just an industry standard. I know it's not up to Google really too much, but that alone is making Elder Scrolls Online really successful on Stadia. Because I talk to a lot of people that, you know, want to play it on the go, portable, on TV, whatever, but they have their account on PC. They've invested 1,000 hours, so it doesn't make sense to get it on their PS5. But if they get it on Stadia, it's the same account. And I think more games need to have that. That could really be where Stadia finds its foothold, is because, you know, remote play on PlayStation is fine, but it's not great. And most of the things that are you can play on xCloud on your phone don't have cross saves with the Xbox versions of the game. So Stadia really, I think, has an opportunity there if they could find a way to get more cross saves and more cross progression in their games.
That would also ease some of the tensions that people are having now about buying a new game. You know, for a lot of people, that $59.99 they spent on the game isn't as big a deal as losing their 2,500 hours in ESO.
Yeah, I also think it's important to understand that what Amazon and Google could do is be that top-level vendor for all the other publishers, right? So instead of Ubisoft launching its own streaming service, it would partner, and it has already partnered with Google and Amazon. And if Google is lending them a portion of the Stadia tech stack or licensing out a way to optimize their games for streaming rather than having them launch, you know, selling them a license to launch their own, I think that would be easier for everybody. And it would, sure, you would take Stadia out of potentially the mind of the player, because you're still just logging into Ubisoft Plus. You would go to Ubisoft whatever UbisoftPlus.com, log in, and it would just, I don't know, use one of the company's tech stacks the way that you know, whichever controller you have, it would just work. I mean, I don't know how that would play out in the long run, but I think Google and Amazon are already fighting for customers in the cloud, right? Google just beat out Microsoft for an enormous cloud partnership with Ford this week, and Ford is committing to using Google Cloud indefinitely. It's going to install Android Automotive and all of its future electric vehicles. Like, this is a big get for Google. And a lot of the cynical takes I'm hearing are Google just wants another vendor, another win for its cloud business. And if we looked at Google's earnings on Tuesday, the day after they announced the shutter of SG&E, you can see that's exactly what's happening. Google Cloud is growing, it's earning record revenues, and Ruth Porat, the CFO, is just tightening the belt in areas where it's going to continue to be extremely expensive, and first-party games are very, very expensive.
I think that's an interesting idea, because what you're kind of proposing is almost like a top-level Ubisoft Connect-style feature each publisher would have that would be powered by a cloud platform like Stadia. So, like, you could, you know, buy a game from Bethesda, and they would give you the version of it that has cloud saves across all platforms. And that would be pretty cool. You know, I think that would be awesome. And it's better. I mean, it's better than no cross progression, but it's not as good as full cross play. You know, like games like, you know, like Warzone or Fortnite, those games that have cross play on every single platform, that I think that's the, you know, eventual future that we're all building towards, hopefully. But at least being able to carry the save across, especially for single player stuff, that would be huge. If I could, you know, continue playing my save file of, you know, Cyberpunk off of my PS5 and on Stadia, that would be great.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people that buy multiple consoles have that problem. What game do you buy for what platform? Where are your friends if you're playing a multiplayer game? Where does it perform best, etc.? And increasingly, we have access to so many platforms. There's the big three, right? I mean, Nintendo is its own, just yeah, it's its own thing, right? They do get some third-party games, but you don't buy Nintendo, or you don't buy a Switch to play Doom Eternal on it, I hope.
Hey.
I mean, I love the idea of playing Doom Eternal on my phone or like a smaller screen, but I saw the Digital Foundry video on that, and it's like, I do not want to play that in handheld mode. That just looks like mush. Anyway, besides the point. But I mean, you have Xbox, you have PlayStation, and then you have all these others. You have GeForce Now, you have Stadia, you have Luna up and coming, and then you have all the different screens and ways to play these games. And it's a little confusing, to be honest, as a gamer. And I don't really, and then obviously PC, with all of the services that you mentioned earlier, David. So it's like, I have access to games everywhere, which is preferable for me.
Yeah, that's a question I ask myself every day.
Yeah, it's,
I mean,
it's,
with the announcement of Mass Effect Legendary Edition, I can't decide. I don't know where to buy the thing. I really can't make up my mind, because I played the original three on PC. It's not coming to Stadia, but I have these hunks of plastic here on the floor that can do 4K 60 frames without any real compromises. So I'm now, which one do I pick? You know, I can't decide. So it's, yeah, the eternal struggle.
All right. So last question I have for you is this shutdown of SG&E going to change the way that you play Stadia, that you think about buying games on Stadia, recommending it to your friends? Will it have any impact on how much you play it versus your other platforms?
I don't think it's going to change the way that I personally interact with it and play it. I've been a pro subscriber ever since the beginning, and I plan on staying as one. But it will, it already has impacted the way I've recommended it to people, because, you know, a lot of people were waiting for a reason to you know, buy a game on Stadia, waiting for an exclusive, waiting on, you know, some indication that there is something unique and, you know, platform selling. And now it seems like whatever that's going to be, it's not going to be coming from Google. And so I've already kind of changed the way that I've talked about it to people, because I still love it. I think it works great. But a lot of people wanted to have reassurances that, you know, the games they buy aren't going to disappear, and reassurances that, you know, there are great things coming very soon. And I just don't know if that's the case anymore. And, you know, more transparency from Google, which is something that's never going to happen, would be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was talks of a roadmap of 400 games over the next couple of years, and then, you know, complete silence about what that even meant. So I don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty. But at the end of the day, every time that I boot up a game that, you know, is like a brand new AAA game and it runs just butter smooth on Stadia, it blows my mind. It still continues to blow my mind. I was completely in shock that Hitman 3 basically ran perfectly. Madden looks and plays just like it does on PS4 with zero problems. Even kicking field goals online, I could still do, which I did not expect to be able to do. So, I mean, it's crazy. You know, it's frustrating because I wish Google believed in Stadia as much as its fans do. And I really wish that they had more confidence in it because it doesn't seem like they do. And it's kind of a shame.
Yeah, that's fair. Now we'll leave it there. David, thank you so much. We end every show with something a little different. It's just one thing that's making us happy this week. So we already did it with our previous guest, Sasha, but we're going to end the show just going over what's making me, what's making Jerry, and hopefully what's making you happy. So it doesn't have to be tech related, but it can be anything that put a smile on your face this week. So I'll let you think about it a second. Do you have something? Ruminate. All right. What's something that's making you happy this week?
My 3-year-old son is very obsessed with Play-Doh right now.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Yeah, every evening he likes to make me dinner. He makes me a platter of food using his little like food processors that, you know, do Play-Doh molds and stuff. So he makes pizza, he makes hot dogs, he makes burgers. And then last night, every night before he goes to bed, we always have little conversations. And last night he told me that whenever he gets big, he wants to make food for everybody. And so I think he wants to be a chef. So we'll see if that stays true.
I love it.
Man, yeah, cherish that, because when he gets older, you're going to just you're going to want him to be making Play-Doh burgers so bad.
Yeah,
but that's beautiful, man. And it's going to make Daniel and me look bad.
Well, I can change what was making me happy to be more in line with David. So Jerry, why don't you go?
Okay, I'm gonna, the nerd Jerry's coming out, because the MediaTek M80 just really makes me happy. It is their new 5G modem, and it's got great millimeter wave support and, you know, mid band support and great speed, and it's chasing Qualcomm. And you know, we talked earlier where Sasha Sagan said that, you know, right now Apple is what has Qualcomm mostly afraid. I want to see other companies keep Qualcomm afraid. I want all these companies to be afraid so they work harder to make better stuff for me to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I see a company like, you know, MediaTek release a great product, and, you know, of course, nobody has seen it in their hands yet, but this looks like it's going to be a great product. That means Qualcomm's next has to be even greater.
That's probably going to happen, because
I know, but Qualcomm's still,
the biggest company in the world.
But imagine
basically,
if Qualcomm had no competition, and we were still.
I mean, they barely have any competition. But that's a different podcast.
Let me have this moment.
Sure, no problem. We'll give it to you. All right. Well, I appreciate that. What's making me happy is a show I'm watching. It's called The Night Of. It's I think an 8-part miniseries. It was released a couple of years ago. It's an HBO show. So it's one of those dark and gritty crime shows. It's basically like the best episode of Law and Order you've ever watched. It is just a really interesting look at how a murder, what happens when somebody's murdered in New York, and all of the people it affects, everything that sort of cascades out from there. The person accused of the crime, who's played by Riz Ahmed, He goes to, I actually shouldn't spoil it much, but he goes to jail. He tries to beat the rap. The woman who is murdered, you find all this out in the first episode, so I'm not really spoiling anything. And it's just everybody in prison at Rikers Island. It's just a fascinating look. All the detectives, the lawyers. It's if you like crime shows, this is as good as it gets. The dialogue's really good, and it stars Michael K. Williams as a former boxer who's in prison for murder, who basically just like runs the show at Rikers. And that's Omar from The Wire. So if you're a fan of The Wire, you're probably going to want to watch this.
And this sounds fantastic.
That's all I'm going to say about it. It came out in 2016, not 2018, but I just discovered this and I highly, highly recommend it. So yeah, it's called The Night Of.
I'm going to put that very high on my list then. It sounds similar to Unbelievable. Did you watch that on Netflix?
Yeah, it is very similar. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because Unbelievable was like based more out in like rural America, whereas this is based in like Manhattan and New York City in general, it's got a very different vibe. And the main lawyer is played by John Turturro. And I would watch anything John Turturro's in. He's incredible in this. And oh man, it's got so much. So yeah, highly, highly recommend it. All right, that's our show. David, thank you so much for joining us for the second half of this. If people want to find you on Twitter or on the internet in general, where can they do that?
On Twitter, they can find me at David, DAVID underscore Jagno. That's JAGNEAUX. And as you said earlier, I'm the senior editor at Upload VR, and I freelance a lot of different places, but currently most often is Android Central, obviously, or Stadia coverage. I write about MMOs at Forbes, and I review and preview a lot of just random stuff at IGN. Those are my my main areas that I haunt.
Awesome. Cool. That's really interesting.
You work too hard, man.
Yeah, exactly. Make us look bad.
I don't even like working.
Sleep is overrated.
Yeah. I don't even like working one job, and you've got all them jobs.
Shut your mouth, Jerry. That's enough out of you. All right. You can find Jerry at GB Hill. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of us at Android Central. Thank you so much for listening. We love hearing your thoughts. Email us podcast@androidcentral.com. We will be back next week with another very cool guest. We will tease it a little bit as we get closer to airing. But until then, have a great week, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Adios.